It's time to take the quiz.
5 questions, 5 minutes a day, 5 days a week.
Take the quiz every weekday at thequiz.fox and then listen to the quiz podcast to find out how you did.
Play, share, and of course, listen to the quiz at thequiz.fox.
Hello, everybody. This is Martha McCallum, and welcome to this week's episode of The Untold Story. And there's a lot of untold story unfolding on Capitol Hill right now when it comes to choosing a Speaker of the House for the newly Republican majority that was established in the midterm election. And I'm really glad to welcome James Freeman of The Wall Street Journal and also a Fox contributor to join me today, because I know you've been watching this all very closely, James, as well. So thanks for being with me.
Thanks, Martha. Great to be here.
So they've just, you know, this will air for the next several days. But what happened just now is that they had a seventh round vote that Kevin McCarthy lost. There were 19 votes for Byron Donalds and I think 212 for Hakeem Jeffries on the Democrat side and one for Donald Trump. So what do you think about where we are now?
Yeah, so I guess perhaps this won't age well. Mr. McCarthy keeps trying to put together the 218 votes he needs. But so far, as we sit here after his seventh loss, where he really has not gained any ground over the last few days in terms of persuading the holdouts, I think it's time for Republicans, I would say, to start thinking about a plan B here. I think there's a sense that the people resisting a McCarthy speakership are motivated by something other than policy, but what they're saying is they really want commitments that there's going to be a change in Washington in how Congress does business. There's going to be a better process. There's going to be spending restraint, a greater commitment to counter Democrats to secure the border. So we've seen Mr. McCarthy negotiate and offer some concessions, but I think the basic case of the holdouts, I think, is that they don't think he's ready to challenge Washington and the way it does business the way another candidate might.
Well, here's what's so interesting to me about this. And, you know, I think there's a sense among a certain group of Republicans and conservatives that it's, you know, that this is embarrassing, that this looks terrible, that they need to show unity. They won. They should, the former president said, they should, you know, accept the victory and pick Kevin McCarthy and move on. And then there's also another faction, which we hear and see a lot of on social media and elsewhere, who says, you know, so what? So what if it takes a little time? It's a messy process. We are sick and tired of $1.7 trillion omnibus bill that gets pushed through in the middle of the night spending our taxpayer dollars. And why can't we push the debt ceiling and have a serious conversation about increasing our debt to astronomical numbers all the time? And, you know, then folks say, well, you know, yeah, there's agreement on those issues, but there really isn't. Because what happens is it just keeps getting, the can on that keeps getting kicked down the road, even though everybody says, tisk, tisk, this is deplorable.
Yeah, and the nature of debt crises is or of entities, whether it's businesses or countries that take on too much debt, is it's not a problem until it is. You know, it's not always easy to forecast what it is that is going to make the world's investors suddenly think the U.S. government is too indebted or suddenly start to doubt the U.S. dollar. Obviously, we're in a very good position historically, and we benefit greatly from really the entire world wanting to own U.S. assets. But you look at this debt level, over $30 trillion officially, but really more like $100 trillion plus if you count all the entitlement promises politicians have made into the future. So I think as interest rates head up and the cost of servicing federal debt becomes larger and it starts to crowd out other priorities, it's possible people making this case now will look very prescient very soon. Mm-hmm. Now, I hope that doesn't happen. I hope we never have a debt crisis, but it's not an inconsequential issue. And I think maybe people have taken for granted because we've had this period of very low rates that it's not an issue, but eventually I think history would say it will be an issue. So I couldn't agree with people more if they're thinking this is a reasonable, healthy debate. Now, there is the question, I understand, of what the real motives are for particular members of Congress, and is it really a personal problem with McCarthy that they are presenting as a policy issue? But it's not. This is not a constitutional crisis. The website, the official website of the House, has the history. This used to be actually fairly common. We talk about how there hasn't been this speakership issue where you had multiple rounds of voting since 1923. But prior to that, it was pretty common. 14 times in our history, and starting from the third Congress, or perhaps even earlier. Records are a little sketchy in the first couple of Congresses. But this is a part of the process, finding the 218 votes to allow you to govern. And Nathaniel Prentice Banks needed 133 ballots in 1805. To become speaker. So,
we're only on number seven. And, you know, in those days, obviously, people weren't glued to cable television watching it all play out. So maybe there was a little bit of more of a tolerance for it. But, you know, it is interesting to just sort of allow this process to play out and to see kind of where people stand on it and what the country thinks about it. You know, I think if you look at it from Republican politics, having just secured this very thin majority in the House of Representatives, right? So what can they hope to accomplish during 2023 and 2024 as they head towards the next election, since they don't have the Senate and they don't have the White House? So it kind of becomes, I think, a question of that. What are the goals for this body to demonstrate as you head towards the presidential election?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think that's at the heart of what this debate is about, at least the portion of it that's on the merits. You have a question of, with Democrats holding the White House and the Senate, how much you can reasonably get done. You also have a real debate within the Republican Party about how serious they are about limiting government versus other priorities. We recall when the Tea Party Congress came in, and after the 2010 election, they had the showdown with President Obama in 2011. They were determined to cut spending. Then Vice President Joe Biden went up to the Hill and negotiated, and I think made an offer that he did not expect to be accepted by the Republicans, which is, we'll have a sequester, we'll cut spending, but we're going to cut defense along with social spending. And Republicans said yes to that. You had the sequester, and for a couple of years, people may not remember this, it may seem impossible to believe now, the government actually spent less money one year to the next for 2 years before they decided to break through those caps. So today, I don't know that would be a decision Republicans would make. I think part of what they're wrestling with now is how seriously they need to take this debt problem and this spending problem, and what their priorities should be. So, certainly personal politics come into this, and it may be that McCarthy ends up winning people over, or doesn't end up being the speaker because of more mundane issues and personal relationships. But I think underlying this, there is a serious policy debate about controlling spending, and it gets into details like earmarks. Certainly a strong case that when individual members are allowed to fund their pet projects, they are more likely to accept big overall spending totals. If they don't have that ability to steer money to their favorite causes or projects in their home districts, I do think they tend to take a longer, larger view, maybe you might say a more mature view of what's the appropriate size of government, size of budgets.
Yeah. You know, one of the other things that they're really pushing for, and I think they're not unrelated, is term limits. And they want to have a vote on term limits, these 20 members of the House. And if you have term limits, you sort of, you know, limit the time period where you're kind of owing each other all of these favors and earmarks and things that get stuffed into these bills that, you know, these folks really never have to to pay for, be held accountable on, really. So what is your thinking on that? Is it on that debate?
I certainly understand the impulse, and that you don't want career politicians. I think we all love looking at history when we think of George Washington and great figures who do their service to the country and then return to the plow, you know,
right.
who don't make this their life. And I think you, as a voter, as a taxpayer, it's nice if it's if you have someone who is going to serve, and not just because they don't need to get reelected to have a career, but also because I think it is beneficial to have people in office who have life experience beyond Washington, who understand that there is this wonderful civic life and economy outside of government that tends to work very well when Washington is not interfering with it. So there are certainly arguments for that. The problem, as you suggest, is that means that you don't get experience. Now, if you have a great elected official who ably represents their constituents, then they have to leave. And that seems odd. I think the term limit issue, I don't think they could actually enforce term limits in terms of people not being able to run again for Congress. I assume if that idea ever got anywhere, it would be about stripping seniority and privileges from people if they had been in Congress a certain amount of time so that they would no longer necessarily want to run again.
The Untold Story continues right after this.
Jason in the House, the Jason Chaffetz Podcast. Dive deeper than the headlines and the party lines as I take on American life, politics, and entertainment. Subscribe now on foxnewspodcast.com or wherever you download podcasts.
You know, the other big story that we're watching today is President Biden talking about the border. And he came out today with this message about explaining that there are various legal ways to enter the country. You can be sponsored by an American citizen or an American company. You can obtain a visa, and also a plan where he would allow 30,000 people to come into the country, and you know that if you got caught trying to cross and you had been an applicant to that program, then you would not be able to come into the country. We're facing a situation right now, so that would be 30,000 a month, where we have about 210,000 a month that are crossing, 2.3 million in 2022. What did you think of his proposals today and the fact that he is finally going to the border after being asked why he hadn't been there for 2 years?
Well, if he's finally, I guess I should step back and say I have trouble analyzing the president on this issue because I think it kind of defies explanation. There was a book recently saying he'd been very frustrated that people weren't proposing solutions, and it seems like much of his term he has spent ignoring it as opposed to looking for solutions. So I'm not sure how he views this issue, but this is positive that he's finally going. This is positive he's finally interested in talking about how you solve this sort of lawlessness and chaos. I think if he wants to take this issue seriously, there's a lot he could do. I think he would find, and I'm hoping he'll come to this conclusion, that this is one policy area where he really could get a lot done in a bipartisan way over the next couple of years. The idea that you go for stronger enforcement and more legal pathways. You mentioned some of them. You also could have a very robust guest worker program. You could have more pathways for different categories of legal migration. But I think we've learned in this era that those reforms, which are very beneficial, we have a worker shortage in the United States right now that's still near historic levels, they have to be paired with enforcement measures so that the border is respected, laws are respected, and you can build the coalition necessary to do this. Is he finally ready to take that step? I don't know. I'm not sure why he hasn't done it already. I thought it was very disappointing during the Trump
years. Well, he blamed Republicans. He said they're not willing to negotiate.
Yeah, and this, you get the feeling people like the politics of this issue more than they want to solve it sometimes. I was very frustrated during the Trump years that I felt there were moments where the Democratic leadership could have gotten a lot of what they say they want in terms of reform, but they were not willing politically to give Trump his wall. And I would hope that now maybe, you know, you don't call it Trump's wall, and maybe you do it differently and you use different measures. But I think we all have to agree that it's not really tenable to say, I believe in a nation of laws, I believe in the rule of law, but I just don't think we should have it along the Rio Grande. It's just not a reasonable position. And obviously we've seen it ends up being a humanitarian disaster for migrants and everyone else really who's caught up in that mess. So I can't make any predictions, but I think there is still a huge opportunity for the president if he wants to take it.
Yeah, it's an area where I think a lot of citizens of this country would like to see people behave like grownups and not hang it on a political gain that they're not willing to let go of, and that they're willing to actually see some progress made. And we clearly need a southern border. I mean, we need... What we have isn't working, and it's very uncompassionate, as you just pointed out. So we definitely need to, you know, it seems if anything could get solved, it should be this. And yet for decades, it's been kind of getting worse and worse. Before I let you go, James, I want to go back to the other topic and ask you to kind of look into your crystal ball. Where do you think this all goes, and how long do you think it takes?
Well, as we talked about through history, it could take a long time, and they don't really need to vote on anything for a while. I know people have said that they want people to be sworn in so that members who are on the intelligence committees and so forth can get classified briefings. But I don't know that there's actually action needed on any front in Congress in the immediate future. So this could go on a while. I just think that it's, unless Mr. McCarthy finds that bundle of 218 votes today, I think there's an argument to see who can get 218. So if I were advising the Republicans, I would say get together in a closed-door conference meeting tonight and do test votes. I think this would probably require Mr. McCarthy to say, I'm willing to step aside and test Steve Scalise. Can he get 218? Jim Jordan, whoever else might be an option. And if you have the same holdouts saying no to everyone, then I think then you have to say, well, they are being unreasonable. There's really nothing they're willing to accept. But I have a feeling that that some of the other options might get 218. But the point is, if we're looking for a way out here, if Republicans are looking for a way out, I think that's a good way to find out if you have another option.
It's really fascinating. Before I let you go, what are you working on these days outside of these issues? What are you writing?
Well, let's see. I think an interesting theme over the next few years, we've talked about this, is the kind of reality of alternative energies, mm-hmm. which have been interesting to a lot of people. Obviously, alluring and a very attractive cause for a lot of people, but you need reliable power at a reasonable price, and so we're seeing that some of these technologies that are now getting funded and approved and are going to be relied upon have downsides like other existing forms of energy. So we've talked about offshore wind farms, interesting issues where people are starting to realize they're not without environmental footprints. They definitely disrupt the natural habitats that they're installed in. They use a lot of materials that require a lot of fossil fuel burning to create. In other words, if you have a solar farm, the materials to create those panels, many of them manufactured in China, are manufactured in a very fossil fuel intensive mm-hmm. process. Obviously, then you need to clear lots of the landscape, whether if it's a solar or wind farm and on land, that displaces a lot of wildlife because these are not highly concentrated forms of energy like a barrel of oil is, where it explodes if you drop a match in it. So then you see offshore, obviously, that has a a footprint and a price as well. So I think this may be an era where people are going to get a better understanding of the costs of moving away from efficient energy toward less efficient intermittent energy. And I think you're starting to see some environmentalists embracing nuclear power. And I think that will have to be a much bigger part of the solution if they really want to get to net zero carbon or whatever the plan is a decade, two decades, three decades from now.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I mean, it's a fascinating thing. You've dug into it, and we have a bit as well with regard to these ocean wind farms. The concrete platform that holds them up is the size of almost two football fields drilled into the ocean floor, and then a cable is run across the ocean floor from that platform to a gathering station that goes up to the coastline to another storage area. And it's fascinating to me that the same group, so, you know, when I was growing up, the Sierra Club and Greenpeace wanted to save the whales. Now they're quiet on this issue. And these wind farms are being placed in areas or planned to be placed in areas where right whales live. They're near extinct. I think there's somewhere between 270 and 300, I think somewhere in that neighborhood left. And the Save the Whales people seem to be ending up on the other side of the political spectrum. So it's a fascinating thing that is developing here. And I hope you and I can talk more about it, because I think you're right. I think it's a big 2023 story.
Yeah, I would love to. Thanks. And kudos for the reporting on this. I think it's, I agree. It's going to be a big issue. So it should be interesting.
Thank you, James. Great to have you with us. James Freeman of the Wall Street Journal and Fox. Great to be with you today.
Thanks.
You've been listening to The Untold Story with Martha McCallum. Don't forget to subscribe on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. Make sure to rate and review. For more podcasts, go to foxnewspodcast.com. Listen ad-free with the Fox News Podcast Plus subscription on Apple Podcasts. And Amazon Prime members can listen to this show ad-free on the Amazon Music app.
The Fox News Rundown, a contrast of perspectives you won't hear anywhere else. Your daily dose of news twice a day, featuring insight from top newsmakers, reporters, and Fox News contributors. Listen and subscribe now by going to foxnewspodcasts.com.